From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the end of net neutrality. Is reducing government regulation of internet service providers better for customers, as the FCC chairman says, or worse for everyone? Also today, the Lowells of Massachusetts, how one family, from Percival on through Amy Lowell, wove its way through 300 years of American history. Plus, can a mother forgive her child's killer? Alyssa Parker did, after another daughter asked,
"What about the boy who shot Emily? What happens to him?" And so my husband posed the question to her, "Well, what do you think God thinks of him?" And her response was, "I think that God still loves him, but is really sad about the choices that he made."
An incredible story of faith and forgiveness. Coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The debate over net neutrality pretty much comes down to the question of control versus access. Is reducing government regulation over internet service providers good for customers and the economy, as FCC Chairman Ajit Pai said yesterday when he announced plans to relax government oversight of ISPs? Or is that bad for the internet ecosystem as a whole, all those other businesses that fear ISPs could have the power to throttle down or block how their data moves around the information superhighway? How's that for a throwback Thursday term? Well, joining us now to discuss is Asma Khalid. She leads WBUR's Bostonomics team. Asma, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Also with us today is Boston Globe columnist Hiawatha Bray. He writes for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, are you there?
Yep, right here.
It's great to have you back on the show. Asma, let me just start with you. What exactly did FCC Chairman Pai suggest yesterday? What has he vowed to do?
So, you know, basically, he has said that the internet was this sort of glorious system for many years when there was this sort of light touch regulation, which was the way it was. He called it actually the greatest free market success story in history. But then he said that in recent years, there's been heavy-handed regulation and that has hurt innovation and that it's, you know, potentially sort of not led to as much job growth. And so he outlined a plan to essentially curb government regulation of the internet. And one key aspect of this is net neutrality, mm-hmm. right? That's what a lot of folks think about when they sort of heard the FCC chairman's comments. And net neutrality is essentially this Obama-era policy that requires internet service providers to treat all online data equally. And Ajit Pai is, you know, he says that net neutrality has kind of taken on this life of its own. He was very critical of the idea that there were really ever any real threats to the quote-unquote, you know, you were saying, information mm-hmm. superhighway because of net neutrality. He says people had warned that regulation would create all of these hypothetical problems.
"We were warned that without it, the internet would suddenly devolve into a digital dystopia of fast lanes and slow lanes. The truth of the matter is that we decided to abandon successful policies solely because of hypothetical harms and hysterical prophecies of doom."
And so Meghna,
hysterical, you know, prophecies of doom. Okay.
And so he says that this just wasn't a reality, that these things were sort of brought in to kind of almost fearmonger, right? And so he has outlined a plan to essentially roll back net neutrality, and that's what he did yesterday.
Okay, so Asma, I'm going to come back to you in a second because you've done some reporting on how Boston's local tech economy is responding to this. But Hiawatha, let me bring you into this conversation. Are you a hysterical doomsayer?
No, I'm not. I'm just the opposite. This is one of those cases where I'm inclined to agree with the Trump administration. I have been covering the internet now for 20 years, and we have consistently heard people warn us that the companies controlling our access to bandwidth are going to start stifling our ability to access certain kinds of internet when it is in their commercial interest to do so. It just isn't happening.
But you know what investors say. I'm going to jump right in here on you.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to use a financial analogy. Investors always tell you past performance is no indication of future behavior.
No, that's fair enough. And I talk about this in the column I wrote. You can make a legitimate point that because these guys are monopolies in many parts of the country, they could conceivably do that. In my opinion, the way to deal with that is to simply pass a basic law that says here are a couple of things or two or three things we will not allow internet providers to do, period. Instead, the FCC took this hugely complex set of regulations written to manage the phone company in the 1930s and is going to try to apply it to the internet. And I just don't see the necessity of it. It doesn't make any sense. If there's a particular specific harm you're worried about, pass a law against it and leave it at that. Yep. Net neutrality opens up all kinds of doors. For example, the legislation with Title II of the Communications Act theoretically gives the federal government the right to set the rates that companies can charge for internet access, just to give you one example. You could end up with rate-setting procedures like we used to have for the phone company. You could have all kinds of bureaucratic intrusions. And in fact, I talked to a professor at Harvard, Susan Crawford, who's very much an internet activist, who said, yeah, good, one of these days, that's our next step. We're going to try to get things like federal rate regulation for internet companies.
Well, she has. She's one of those folks who has talked about maybe we ought to move to an era of regulating ISPs like utilities. But I'm going to...
Exactly, I don't see the point.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold on here for a second, Hiawatha. By the way, just as an aside, I saw that Senator John Thune from South Dakota has actually suggested that he likes legislation that would just prevent blocking, throttling, or paying for prioritization and just take care of that corner. So maybe that is that same compromise you're talking about.
It just seems to me something like that. Oh, by the way, I get in trouble because I don't think they should be I don't think paid prioritization should be illegal at all. I don't even understand why people are complaining about that.
You hang on there, Hiawatha. I'm going to come. I can explain to you why people are complaining about that.
I want to bring Asma back in
because she's actually also been talking to members of the local tech economy in Boston who've got some pretty strong feelings about this. So tell me what they've been telling you as well.
Sure. And so, Meghna, maybe I should first hit at this concern around paid sort of prioritization of access, because that is something that did come up specifically from Mike O'Hanlon. He works in government relations for the e-commerce site Wayfair that's based here in Boston. And he told me he's not really worried so much about what rolling back net neutrality could mean for Wayfair, but he says he's worried about what it could mean for the startup ecosystem.
We think an open internet is key for the next generation of innovators to be able to come down the pike. We think the direction away from net neutrality is one where, you know, some of those new services and products could be stifled.
And so, Meghna, that was, I would say, a fairly common concern that people had, is just that they worry a lot about what this could mean for startups at this early stage if you don't really have, they're saying, sort of easy access to everything.
So, Hiawatha, just to dovetail with what Asma said, you know, 800 startups sent a letter to FCC Chairman Pai saying without net neutrality, incumbents who provide access to the internet are going to be picking winners and losers in the market.
Is there any sign that any of these companies have been doing that? No. That's my point. As I said before, the blocking and throttling thing, I think everybody agrees they shouldn't be allowed to do that. But paid prioritization drives me crazy because there's this company down the street in Cambridge. It's called Akamai. They're one of the most important internet companies in the world. What do you think they do? Their whole business is paid prioritization. Well, not their whole business. They do other things, too. But one of the key things they do is you pay them money to make sure that your internet data gets there ahead of other people's. It's perfectly legal. It's gone on for decades, and it hasn't harmed a soul. I don't get it. This is no different from saying you can buy two-day delivery or one-day delivery at FedEx. How is that unfair? I don't get it. Blocking and throttling, I agree, are unfair. But the idea that the internet should not, that a company shouldn't be able to buy better internet service, why shouldn't they?
But how are consumers going to know? How am I going to know that what's arriving at me was privileged by companies that are able to pay versus those that are not? I mean,
that's a great question. In most cases, if you couldn't tell, why would it matter? Let me give you an example.
It matters on principle, Hiawatha.
No. Let me give you an example. Say you're watching video. This is a perfect illustration of what people say they're worried about. NBC is owned by Comcast. They could take their internet streams involving NBC materials, or they also own Universal Studios. And anything from NBC or Universal Studios would get better delivery than, say, something from YouTube. But if they did that, you'd notice. That would be the whole point of doing it. So you'd notice. So you'd see a decrease in quality. And don't you think people would complain about it? People would freak.
Okay. That's a good point, because I'm already freaking just thinking about it. But Asma, jump back in here.
I mean, that is a particular concern I have heard from some tech executives. You know, the CEO of Carbonite, which offers cloud backup services, says, sure, you know, this might all be hypothetical. He acknowledges that. But he also says, well, why wait until there's a problem? He thinks historically we have seen utility companies, particularly when they have monopolies, behave in a certain way. And he told me that he was personally concerned because there's nothing really stopping an internet service provider from prioritizing content. So, you know, he said, for example, they work in the cloud backup service world. Verizon actually offers a cloud backup service as well. He tells me he thinks that it's inferior to what Carbonite has to offer. But he's wondering, well, if no one is watching, who's to stop Verizon from subsidizing the bandwidth of their own product and just making it faster than Carbonite?
Right. Well, I mean, wasn't it?
No, somebody would be watching. Absolutely. And you know, that's one of those cases where you might have a point, but again, you don't need the entire panoply of telephone regulation to deal with that problem. To the extent that it's an issue, pass a law.
Okay.
Like you said, there is support on Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle to do something like that. I grew up in the era of the regulated phone industry, the Bell system. It is amazing how much innovation those guys stifled because they had absolutely no economic incentive to invent anything. They were a totally regulated monopoly, and the phones worked great, but all the other technologies that they invented, like, for example, they invented a telephone answering machine. They didn't bring it to market. They didn't see the point.
Yeah.
They invented DSL, a cheaper way of sending digital communication. They didn't bring it to market.
Yeah, but then those regulated monopolies got broken up and the problem was solved, right?
Because they were broken up and they weren't regulated!
I'm waiting to hear for someone to call for the breakup of Comcast, but Asma, jump back in here.
You know, this question.
That's a different argument. That's actually a different and a better argument. I would rather hear somebody argue that we should break up Comcast.
Are we firing? Are you and I finding common ground, Hiawatha? I think this is
Well, I'm not sure they should break it up, but I think you can make a strong case that it is, you know, you could argue that maybe we shouldn't have let them buy NBC or something like that. I'm not saying I'm absolutely convinced of that, but that's, I think, a much sounder argument in terms of antitrust concerns. That's where I really worry about these guys because they do have monopolies.
Right.
And that's a real problem. I agree with you.
I'm going to just pull Asma back in here because she's the voice of reason between the polls that you and I represent.
There's no reason up in here today.
I mean, I think that this concern, right, of regulation or deregulation, I think what's so fascinating to me is you can listen to Ajit Pai and then I can hear from a number of Boston Tech executives and everybody says that they want the same thing. Everybody is telling me that, you know, well, Ajit didn't talk to me. I listened to him, but you know, they're all saying we want innovation, we want job growth, and we want a free and open internet. And so everybody's saying that they want the same thing, but they feel like diametrically opposed about how you get there. You know, there's one other sort of just quick example I want to give. I spoke to the CEO of Lionbridge. It's a software company in Waltham, and they have operations in some, I think, like 36 countries. And so he gave me the example of what what concerns him is he says that, and maybe this is a sort of tangential argument, but he's worried that by rolling back net neutrality, it will affect even greater sort of internet access in the United States. And so he talked to me a bit about when they have business operations, they get, say, 50% of their revenue from overseas. He gave me examples of Finland, South Korea, where there's just tremendous internet access and availability. And he says in those situations, he's seen competition increase.
Because of the regulations?
And he would make the case that in Finland, yes, you know, Finland has mandated sort of certain levels of broadband that is available, and they did this a few years ago. So this is his argument, is that, yes, when you actually have some sort of government rules and the internet is available to everyone, he feels that it increases competition.
Hiawatha, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a different question and a much more difficult one, because what you're talking about there is access as opposed to net neutrality. Huge parts of this country do not have good broadband access, and you're absolutely right about that. If you want me to tee off on the cable and internet companies, let me give you an example of something I think is outrageous. Many states have passed laws that do not allow municipalities to build their own internet networks, and I think that's nuts. There are towns that have had some considerable success vote where the taxpayers vote and they say, we'll build our own, but the state government is saying, we're not going to allow you, a city in, I don't know,
Western
Missouri
Massachusetts. Yeah.
Right. No, I don't think that law exists in Massachusetts. But there are states where they're told, you know, in your city, you can't build your own internet network. And I think that's wrong. That would help spread the bandwidth around. And we really do need that. The big problem is, indeed, there's not enough of it. There's not enough competition. And we've got to find better ways to deal with that.
We just got a couple seconds left. Asma Khalid, you get the last word of the day.
Well, I guess I'll just tell people sort of what's next.
Yeah.
So at this point, you know, the FCC chairman said that he would release his full document proposal. The FCC did release more, so just sort of clarification of what exactly it's proposing. It's online at the FCC's website if you want to read more details. And then they are planning a vote in mid-May. I believe it's May 18th. So, you know, yeah, we'll sort of see where things are between now and then. But I will say what's interesting is, you know, you are hearing from tech leaders in the Boston world. You're hearing from some politicians. This is an issue that really is galvanizing a lot of people on a whole lot of fronts.
Right.
Well, it's not going away.
No, it's
not. There will be, whatever the FCC does, there will be court challenges. So even if they change the rule, it may survive. So don't forget that.
Exactly. And, you know, the last time that we went through this in 2015, I think something like 4 million pieces of letters or input were given to the FCC when this battle happened. One can only think,
oh, yeah,
you know, Moore's Law,
we're
right?
Talking
so it's
about
gonna
this
be like 4
years
trillion
to come.
This. Hiawatha Bray, tech columnist for the Boston Globe. It's always great to have you, Hiawatha. Thanks so much.
Yeah, great to be here.
And
all right,
Asma Khalid, head of WBUR's Bostonomics team. Thank you so much, Asma.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you look back into the history of almost any long-standing New England family, you'll probably find some combination of the following: farmers, laborers, ministers, spinsters, academics, writers, soldiers. But when that family is the Lowells, the list also includes college presidents, abolitionists, lawyers, inventors, astronomers, factory owners, and Pulitzer Prize-winning poets. A family as complex as the more than 300 years of American history they've lived through. Well, author Nina Sankovich tells the story of the venerable Massachusetts family from their arrival in the 1600s to the 20th century in her fascinating new book, The Lowells of Massachusetts, An American Family. And she joins us now from NPR in New York. Nina Sankovich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, thank you.
It's great to have you. So I'm curious if you could just tell us the genesis story of this fantastic book of yours, because I understand you really wanted to start writing about, or you wanted to arrive at a place where you could write about Amy Lowell. Why her?
Well, I have been fascinated with Amy Lowell since the second grade. I was given a poetry project back then, and although I didn't do too well on the project, I became just obsessed with Amy Lowell. And fast forward a few decades, and I was researching a book on letter writing. So I thought, oh, I'm going to look up the letters of Amy Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to my horror, I discovered that she had in her last will and testament a provision that after her death, all of her personal letters should be burned.
Wow. Yeah.
So I was kind of horrified by that. And then it turned out that many members of her family had that same provision. So then I started thinking, what are these Lowells hiding? You know, what are they trying to do, burning their personal letters? You know, are they curating their image? And that set me off really on a kind of detective hunt. I was going to find out the true stories of the Lowells, the story of Amy and of her siblings. But once I got into the first Lowell, Percival Lowell, who came over in 1639, his story was so fascinating. So then I was just hooked. 10 generations of Lowells I ended up researching. And luckily, I did find plenty of letters sketchbooks and journals and diaries and all kinds of papers.
Well, just so for folks who don't know, Amy Lowell is the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet that we referred to earlier. But before we sort of take this march through history with the Lowell family, were you able to determine why they had this strange family ritual of ordering that their letters be burned upon each Lowell's death?
Well, you know, not all of them had
okay.
that in their will, but it was apparently a sort of common practice in the 19th century. And it was this idea of exactly that, of curating the image you left behind, of not leaving anything too personal behind.
Ah, okay. Oh, interesting. That sounds, I was about to say, that sounds very Puritan, but is that?
Yeah.
But maybe we should just talk about the first Lowell himself, Percival, whom you mentioned. 1639, that's the year that he and his wife arrived?
Yeah. Okay. And what is so interesting about Percival is that he decided to emigrate to America at the age of 68.
Right.
So that is a ripe old age in those days, particularly, to take off on a 9-week voyage across the sea and start over completely in a, you know, just a new country in a tiny town. He came from the town of Bristol, which was this thriving port town. You know, he'd had a pretty cosmopolitan life, and to leave that behind and then go to, you know, this rural Puritan enclosed village was really quite a big change for him.
What was Percival's station in life in Bristol?
He was an importer-exporter. The Lowells had a coat of arms that they had paid for during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, so they were so-called gentlemen. But times were hard in England in 1639. There were all kinds of taxes and fees that Percival had to pay. There were a lot of bribes he had to pay to keep his business going. Harvests had failed for the second year in a row. Disease was rampant. I mean, it's really unbelievable that both Percival and his wife made it into their 60s. There was a new war threatening. Charles I wanted to go to war against Scotland in the Bishops' Wars. And just things were not good. So
right.
Percival just decided to pack up, and he and his party of 13 took off across the sea.
It is an amazing story, given you know the age, as you said, that he was. And so when he came, when he landed on these shores, again, did he take his privilege and his money with him, or? I mean, because America was such a different place.
Right, right. Well, he certainly brought his money with him, which allowed him to buy into the town. But he arrived in Boston, and he had met someone from the town of Newbury, the really village of Newbury, on the voyage over. So he decided to take his crew north to Newbury. And the town was happy to have him, but he and his family had to really agree to live by the dictates of the town. They had to be accepted into the town. Which they did because they saw that this was, you know, a real opportunity for them to put down roots. And it was a congregational town, so there were strict, you know, Puritan dictates. But really what resonated for Percival and what you see then throughout the history of the Lowells was there was in the town, you had to work very, very hard, develop your individual talents for the good of the entire town.
Uh-huh.
So you weren't just there for your family or for yourself. You really had to put your all into it for the good of the whole community. And because it wasn't a big community, your roles could be multiple. I mean, you could be both a farmer and someone who worked in government. A woman who, whereas in England, had very strict and limited roles, so all of a sudden she comes to America, she could be a mother, an apothecary, a midwife. And so there's an incredible kind of flourishing of opportunity combined with this duty to community that I just found so interesting.
Interesting. And so how does that sort of animating force in the Lowells of America play out, let's jump forward more than a century here, in the American Revolution?
Well, it was interesting to see how the Lowells had to really arrive at a place where they left behind their duty to the king, which was really sort of they had been bred to be dutiful, citizens, loyal subjects to the King of England. Things had to get to such a point that they reinvented what their community was. Now their community was no longer England as a whole, but this new possible country. And that wasn't an easy decision to make. That wasn't an easy transformation to make. But so to go through the documents and see how they arrived at that and how they then sort of redefined their community and their duty to this new community of this, you know, the colonies coming together to form a new country, that was how this Lowell sense of duty then, you know, transformed itself during the revolutionary period.
Fascinating. Well, you know, it's so interesting, the Lowells that you write about in the book, we could spend our entire conversation talking about any single one of them.
Absolutely.
But there are a couple of others I do want to hear about their stories, because we need to talk about Francis Cabot Lowell.
Okay.
He's the Lowell who gives us the Lowell, the name of the city of Lowell
right,
that
right.
we know today. But tell us about him.
Well, he was interesting. I mean, all of them were interesting to me, but he was what was called a happy genius at mathematics when he was at Harvard. And after leaving Harvard, he wanted to go into trade. So he had this opportunity to go to France and travel around France, where he got there in the middle of the revolution. But the revolution really didn't bother him at all. He was just kind of picking up knowledge about what were the good things to trade with France. And then he came back and built up his trade. So later, you know, like when then there was an embargo on goods, and he had this during the Jefferson's presidency, he had this idea, okay, it's not going to be easy for me to trade anymore. Maybe it's time for the United States to really start building up its manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And there's no one better at manufacturing than England. So I'm going to go to England and figure out how they do it. Now, in England at the time, they had very strict controls over who got into a mill and, you know, saw how the looms worked, how manufacturing happened. If you worked for one of these manufacturers, you could not leave the country. You were prohibited from emigrating.
They're protecting their intellectual property.
Really, okay. Yeah, you know, yeah. Fortress-like. Yeah. But somehow he wormed his way into these factories, and he walked around. He didn't take any notes. He kind of walked around whistling, his hands in his pocket, you know, looking like the sweet American. And he picked it all up. He just looked at everything, locked it away in his brain. And then he came back to the U.S. And in fact, on his way back, the British stopped his ship and they searched through all of his luggage. They said, this guy must, you know, he's been looking at our mills. He must have something. But they couldn't find anything because it was all in his head. So they had to let him go. He got back to Boston. He sat down, redrew everything, actually made the looms better, made the whole system better. And he was really determined to not only make the machinery better, but to make the system of the mill towns better.
Yeah.
He was in England during the Luddite Revolution, and he just saw, you know, these workers are miserable, their conditions are miserable. And he had this ideal of what he wanted, these campus-like factories where people, you know, worked hard, but they also had a clean place to live, and they had education opportunities, and they were paid in cash. And the people he wanted to work in his mills were the farmer's daughters of New England, because he knew they worked hard. He knew they wanted to get off the farm and out from under their parents and finally have some money of their own. And he offered them this opportunity. And under Francis Cabot Lowell, these mills were operated that way. Unfortunately, after his death,
it didn't stay that
changed.
Way. Exactly. Right. I was going to say that, like the history of the mills and Lowell is a complicated one.
Absolutely.
But here's also another one of those inflection points that the family sort of represents that along with the moment that we found ourselves in American history, right? Because on the one hand, we have Reverend Charles Lowell, famed abolitionist, right, who just who thunders against things like the Fugitive Slave Act. But on the other hand, the very mills, the Lowell mills that we're talking about, benefited from the cheap price of Southern cotton because of slavery.
Yeah, absolutely. And the mill owners also relied on the South for cash.
Yeah.
You know, when there were times of, you know, financial panic, they needed Southern cash to keep going. And that was something that I saw, you know, throughout the history of the Lowells, was they did not always agree on what their obligation was. They didn't always agree on how they defined the community for which they were working. And so to see that play out, it was really a difficult period for the Lowells, and it was really the wealthier Lowells versus the less wealthy, in fact, even poor Lowells. They took the opposite sides on this. Now, when the Civil War began, they joined together again, really united in their desire to keep the Union whole.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another one here, another one of the Lowells,
okay,
very briefly, because we just got a couple of minutes left. Abbott Lawrence Lowell, 22nd president of Harvard University, a controversial figure in Harvard's history.
Very. Absolutely controversial. And, you know, the way that I saw Lawrence was that he defined his community in such a way that he kept out elements that he did not think fit the ideal college community. And that was a real problem because that meant driving gay students out, allowing black students to study at Harvard, but not allowing them to live in, you know, the residences with the other students. Having a quota on how many Jewish students there could be. So these are the kinds of things that Lawrence did that we, you know, are very controversial. Yeah. But we can't forget all the good things that he did for Harvard also. And, you know, he really built the Harvard both physically and the way the university is run, the way it is still run today, you know, the way majors are and concentrations and the honors program and the housing program. And he broke up where all of the wealthier students lived on this Gold Coast, and he broke that up and said, no, all the students have to live together. Mm. He had this idea of brotherhood, but he excluded large groups of people yeah. from that brotherhood.
Yeah. So we've just got a minute or so here to go. I love the idea that this family and its journey through American history tells us a lot about how we view community and how we view duty to whatever that community is that we're defining. I mean, I'm wondering how you think, what lessons we can learn today from the example of the Lowells.
Well, what I really found at times inspiring about the Lowells was this idea that you are a part of a community and you owe something to that community. You owe your hard work, you owe your allegiance. And it's not a community that's defined by who your family is. It's a community that's defined by however you want to define it. And I think the more broadly we define it, the better we are off as a country. And when I look back at the history of the Lowells, the broader they defined their community, the better kind of things that they did. And so I think that's our lesson. Our lesson is that our American community is a large community. We should all be working to help each other, you know, achieve better things, achieve a greater way of living, greater employment opportunities, that limiting it to people of your social tier, of your family alone, is really dangerous.
Yeah. And another minor lesson, don't burn your letters.
Yeah.
or don't delete your emails, if that's the modern day analogy. Nina Sankovich, author of the new book, The Lowells of Massachusetts, An American Family. It's a truly fantastic read. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And by the way, I should say that Nina will be speaking at the Concord Bookshop on May 7th and at the Harvard Bookstore on May 12th. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a question that no parent ever wants to consider, but I'm going to ask you to think about it anyway. If a child you loved were gunned down in cold blood, could you ever find it in your heart to forgive the murderer? Honestly, I don't think I could. But then you hear about a mom like Alyssa Parker. She forgave her daughter's killer, and his name was Adam Lanza. Emily Parker was just 6 years old when she died at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Lanza killed 20 children and 6 adults that day in 2012. It's an unimaginable horror. And yet somehow, Alyssa Parker has found forgiveness in her heart. And she writes about that in her new book, An Unseen Angel. Alyssa joins us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, Alyssa, I just want to say thank you for the book because it's so brave and so honest. I mean, it's just hard for me to wrap my mind around what it took to forgive the person who took Emily from you. Where did you start?
It was really difficult. The pain of dealing with not just my daughter being gone, but I didn't realize the physical limitations it would put on me, that I just couldn't get out of bed and that it was so difficult to be a mother all of a sudden. And the things that came so natural to me now felt impossible to do, just my day-to-day life.
You know, I am lucky enough to be a mama myself. And I was just walking down the street with my kiddo hand in hand, and it just brought to my mind how you wrote about that there was a time that the pain of losing Emily was so profound that you couldn't even hold your other daughter's hands.
Yeah, it was really difficult. I had this, you know, innate motherly instinct to always keep track of, you know, all three of my kids, and holding hands was something that you know, was a part of my job, and it was really difficult after she died while I would scramble to make sure everyone was holding a hand and somehow connecting to me as we crossed the street to recognize that there was one missing was very unnatural, and it was very difficult. And her hands in particular, I remember such detail about her hands, and she was this artist, and she had developed these calluses on her hand because of all of the artwork that she had created. And I missed her. I missed just connecting with her in that way.
Mm. I mean, there's nothing I feel that could ever replace that singular feeling of your child's, you know, the warmth and strength and uniqueness mm-hmm. of their little palm in yours. Mm-hmm. I mean, given that, I can't even imagine, so tell me if this is wrong, but that there was losing a child is like, it's like getting your soul ripped out from you. There's nothingness. There's blackness after that.
And yeah.
I ask that because, I mean, a big part of the story that you write in the book is the fact that you and your family are Mormons, so faith is central to your life. Was there a moment after, or moments after Emily passed away that you just said, God, how could you have let this happen?
You know, I never really, I didn't respond that way. I wasn't desperate to blame him. I was desperate to get answers from him. Mm-hmm. That was my response.
Mm-hmm. I have a huge amount of admiration for you that was your innate response, because, I mean, I can imagine people who have the exact opposite response.
Right.
You write in the book that I trusted God and knew in my heart he was not my opponent. Rather, he could be my comforter. Mm-hmm. So how did you feel that comfort?
I felt it almost immediately after I found out that Emily died. I remember sitting in my car with my husband, Robbie, and that was the first time we really had been alone that day, because majority of the day had been spent in the firehouse waiting for information with all the other families about our kids. And I remember sitting there with him, and it was quiet, and he decided to say a prayer. And while he was saying the prayer, I immediately heard words run through my mind, and it said that Emily was okay and that everything our family needed to get through this would be provided for. And though the moment was very brief, I felt hope. And after the prayer was over, again, I was swarmed with this grief and shock, and that hope did not last in that moment very long. But over the course of the next few days especially, I looked back on that and wondered, how is he going to fulfill that promise to me? How is he going to see this through? Because right now, the only thing that would see me through would be having my daughter come back. And so it really set the tone, though, for the conversation that I would have with him. You know, okay, you say you're going to help me. This is what I need to know. This is what I need to understand.
So what were the things that you needed to know and needed to understand?
Yeah. There was this talk at Emily's funeral that was given by one of the church leaders from our church, and he had said something about not holding on to the life that I had seen for my daughter, and to not hold on to that pain. And I was doing just that. I had been thinking of all the things that my daughter would not be able to see or do, and I thought, this is where I need help. And so I had gone to God, and I prayed, and I said, I will do whatever it takes to grieve the loss of the life that I saw for my daughter, but I need your help. I need you to help me see her new life. Mm. And I can see something that can somehow give me closure to that life that she will not have, that I had envisioned for her.
And this is such a long process. Maybe journey is actually an even better word, because you write about how there's this really pivotal moment where all of a sudden you understand it, that if you're going to keep going, you needed to meet with Adam Lanza's father, Peter Lanza. How did that happen?
Now, you have to understand, when the shooting happened, the last thing I was really thinking about was my feelings and emotions towards the shooter. I was angry. He was a monster to me. And I felt okay with that for the time being. And it wasn't until my husband shared with me an interaction that he had with our daughter, Madeline, who had just turned six at the time, or five at the time, I'm sorry. And when he was tucking her in for bed, she said, "When do I get to see Emily again?" And he said, "You know, when we are here on this earth, if we make good choices, when we die, we'll be able to see Emily again." And she thought about that for a minute and then said, "What about the boy who shot Emily? What happens to him?" And so my husband posed the question to her, "Well, what do you think God thinks of him?" And her response was, "I think that God still loves him, but is really sad about the choices that he made." And it wasn't until he spoke those sweet words to me that I considered looking at him through different eyes. And I resisted that feeling. I was comfortable feeling angry, and I felt like holding on to that anger was something I deserved,
yeah.
That I was supposed to feel those feelings towards him, that I wasn't supposed to let him off the hook in some way. And that conversation led us to have a meeting with the shooter's father. And, you know, I held on to this idea of, I'm going to share a message with him to inspire this father, Peter Lanza, to make some good out of this horrible situation so that we can learn from what we can about what went wrong with his son. And then the idea of hearing about his son was something that I did not want to be a part of our conversation. I wanted to say what we had to say, and that was about it. But that's not what happened. He really just started to pour his heart out about what he was going through and what he remembers. And I left that meeting seeing him again a different way.
You were also sitting across the table from another parent who had who had experienced a horrible loss.
And I thought to myself, you know, this is a man who's also lost his son, but lost him in a horrific way, where his son has created so much damage along the way. And I couldn't even fathom the pain that that would inflict on me as a parent.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of empathy for his circumstances. I looked at him and I thought, that's tough, right?
But I'm thinking back to, Alyssa, how you said that, you know, it never occurred to you to blame God. But did you want to hold Peter Lanza more accountable? Like, I can, because I'm trying to imagine what I would say if I was sitting across from the father of a shooter. And I would want to say, why couldn't you have done more as his father?
What I felt was, if you feel like I'm attacking you, I am completely taking away an opportunity to learn from what happened to you and your son. And I thought about all of those children who struggle with something similar and their parents who are desperately trying to find answers and find help for their child. And if I isolate this father and I make him feel horrible, I felt like I was turning that finger and pointing it at those parents who were struggling with the exact same thing. And that did not seem at all like the Christ-like thing to do. Hmm. I thought, if I love these children and I want to help them, I don't want to isolate them. I don't want them to feel like their struggles are their fault. I want to learn from what went wrong and see what we can do to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask you to read a little excerpt from your book?
Of course.
About, you know, one of the kind of transformative moments on this journey that you and your family have taken. It's the excerpt on page 139 where you talk about, you know, the more that you learn and you read about the shooter, that you reached a new place, a new understanding.
Of course. I finally came to the conclusion that I would never know. I would never fathom what was in his heart. But God could. God knew how to hold him accountable. That burden was not for me to carry. Rather, it was for me to lay down at God's feet. It was not something I needed to grapple with the rest of my life. I didn't have to judge. I didn't have to figure it out. As I made this decision, a burden so deep and so heavy it nearly crushed me was physically lifted from me. My heart burned with a joy so powerful it brought me to tears. I had learned it was possible to forgive Adam Lanza, and that first step was for me to choose to simply let it go.
That's Alyssa Parker reading an excerpt from her book, An Unseen Angel. Did it really feel like that? Like suddenly you could breathe again a little bit?
Yeah, it truly did. And what was so interesting was when I could physically feel that weight lifted off and that peace instantly replaced it. I knew that that's what Emily wanted for me.
Yeah.
I knew she wanted me to feel happy again. And it was, I think, in my desire and my, you know, my determination to find her that led me to forgive. And she knew my heart needed to heal. She knew that I needed that closure in order to be not only the person that I wanted to be or needed to be, but I was so grateful that that transition, that transformation allowed me to be a mom again.
Yeah. That's the thing about forgiveness, right? It's not just an act that you bestow on someone else.
No,
right?
No, not at all.
It's something that profoundly heals you. It's almost as if you're doing it for yourself.
Right.
But the other thing I think about forgiveness is that it's not just an end state either.
No, not at all. I think that was always my impression, that it was kind of a, you know, a declaration that you then make and move forward, and that's the end. I never really thought of it as a state of being, almost a choice that I had to make over and over again. And there's days that I fail. There's days that I don't have that feeling in my heart, but I get better at it and I get stronger and it gets easier.
Well, Alyssa, I wonder if we could end with a story about Emily and the amazing, luminous little girl that she was. I mean, it's actually the place where you start the book, and you tell us how you started that day in December 2012, and Emily comes into your room, and she gets you out of bed, and she takes you into her room because she wanted to show you some flowers that you'd stenciled onto the wall.
Yeah. So she came over, and she said she just had this most amazing thing that she had discovered, and on the back of the bed, we had stenciled these flowers, and they were her three favorite colors, black and pink and blue. And she said, "Mom, I have the coolest thing to show you." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Look at these flowers. Do you see these two flowers?" She said, "One has a pink center with a black outside, and the other one is pink with a black inside. Do you see it?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "They're connected. Isn't that amazing? There's connections everywhere. If you just look around the world, there's connections. Do you see it?" And those words were so profound to me in the months and the years since her passing, seeing these connections and the connections everywhere. And I hear those words and the voice over and over again in my head every time, you know, I have one of those small little miracles. And I think, do you see the connections, Mom? Mm. They're everywhere.
Well, Alyssa Parker's book is An Unseen Angel. She's also a national advocate and lecturer for school safety through Safe and Sound Schools. Alyssa, thank you so, so much for sharing your story, for writing this book, and for giving us all a much needed lesson on the power of forgiveness. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.